from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, according to a study by the Oakland-based California Healthcare Foundation, a large majority of Californians say they would prefer a natural death at home and at little expense to their families. But the new survey also indicates that more often than not, they don't get their wishes. We discuss the findings of the study and focus on end-of-life issues. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A third of medical expenses in the United States goes to medical care for the elderly in the last months of life. And California, compared to the rest of the nation, is trending toward providing more inpatient care and more intensive care in the last 6 months of life. Nevertheless, most of those patients simply do not have documents such as do not resuscitate. In fact, less than a quarter have put their wishes into writing, despite the fact that a majority, some two-thirds of Californians, prefer a natural death if severely ill and a death at home rather than in a hospital or a nursing home. A new study by the California Healthcare Foundation also reveals that most want to talk with their physicians about what they want in the way of end-of-life care, even though research reveals an ongoing reluctance to talk. On both sides, patients and doctors, we take all this up in this opening hour of Forum. Joining us by phone this morning from San Diego is Kate O'Malley. She's program officer with the California Healthcare Foundation. They manage the project focused on improving care at the end of life. And Kate O'Malley, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
We also have Lisa Krieger here with us in studio, a higher education reporter who did a very moving and poignant piece about her father in the San Jose Mercury News, a personal story of her experience as her father died, which had an extraordinary response. And Lisa, good to see you again. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Alexander Smith here with us in studios, assistant professor of medicine in the UCSF Division of Geriatrics, also co-founder of GeriPal. That's a blog and tweets at Alex Smith MD. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Charles Garfield with us, founder of Shanti, clinical professor of psychology at UCSF and a visiting scholar at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And Charlie Garfield, it's been a long time. Glad to have you back on Forum. I'm sorry you're laid up with a broken hip.
Well, it's a hip replacement and it's doing well and it's good to be with you.
Glad to have you here. I'm going to begin, if I may, Kate O'Malley, with you, and let's get a rundown from you on what you found. There's a lot of statistics in this report, and we'll tell people how to get it online, but basically, I think it's important to highlight, first of all, a tremendous chasm and gulf between what people say they want and what they're doing.
Yes, that's true. In the survey that we did, we found 1,600 people who represented a profile of Californians in terms of ages and ethnicities and different political backgrounds, and we asked them a series of questions and found a lot about the preferences that they have not being elicited, conversations that they hope to have with their providers not being initiated, and really found a big gap, and also between what people say that they want to do and the steps that they actually take to make those actions a reality. There are lots of things that people could do in terms of filling out simple forms to identify their directives for medical care in the future, or if they have a more serious illness and those decision needs are more pressing, they can engage in a process called physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. And we've been doing a lot of work in California to promote these types of processes. And the survey was really served a couple of purposes for us to find out who's out there and listening and hearing what's going on and what are they doing about it. And then also to do exactly what we're doing today, start a conversation that will bring the necessity for these conversations into a more normal type of conversation, day-to-day life.
It is an important conversation, and of course we'll talk about why it may be taboo for many people, but I was struck by the fact that over half of the people you spoke with say they want to have their end-of-life wishes in writing, but less than a quarter of them actually do that. I mean, that's pretty telling.
Yes, it is, and I think we tried to drill down a little bit further as to why. And again, this is a representative sample of Californians, so it's all age groups. And many people have a lot of other things to worry about, and life is very busy. So if it's not a simple process and easily accessible and in the mainstream of day-to-day life, it's much more likely that, like doing a will, people just might tend to put it off. And so I think our job really is to identify the need to make this part of normal everyday life.
Well, here's one of the biggest gulfs, just for listeners to absorb. 80% of the people you spoke to said they would like to talk about these issues with their doctors or doctor, physician. Only 7% have.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's one of those interesting dynamics where it's possibly that physicians who may or may not feel they have the type of skill or the time, I think both are equally pressing, are kind of waiting for patients to bring up the issue, and maybe patients are thinking, well, my doctor would know what's happening with me, and if it's important to talk about this now, maybe my doctor will bring it up. So we're in a weird kind of standoff where it's a wanted activity, but it's not being initiated and owned in any particular place.
I'm sorry, I was just going to mention Kate O'Malley with a senior program officer with California Healthcare Foundation. You're at a conference in San Diego, Kate?
Yes, we are. We have actually, we're meeting with national leaders in the Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment effort across the country. We are co-sponsoring this, and we have representatives from 33 different states. So there's a lot of growing interest about how to find ways to solve and address these issues. And we're also meeting with the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California, having their annual meeting. And we've got close to 250 people each day. So the interest is there, and the processes are coming along as well. I think the challenge is to get the word out and to really enlist as many champions as we can.
Well, 70% of those you spoke to, I just want to get some of these other statistics out, said they would prefer to die at home, but only 30% in 2008 did die at home, 42% in hospitals and 15% in nursing homes. And there again is another one of those chasms or gulf that I alluded to earlier. You also mentioned ethnic differences, and over half of the Latinos say they want to live as long as possible. What do we make of that?
Well, I mean, I'd be curious to hear others' impressions of this as well. I wonder sometimes, and we didn't drill down to, so I can't speak for everyone who answered that question the way they answered it, but I would say perhaps religious influences play a role there, and I'd be curious to hear what other people's experiences have been clinically as well, working with people from different ethnic groups.
Well, we'll hear from callers on that, no doubt, and I'll give out the number after we speak with some of our guests here. We have a whole panel of people, and this is not a death panel, by the way, lest anybody think otherwise. We really have to debate extension of life and determining life expectancy and all those kinds of things, and not necessarily run into interference with all this talk about death panels, hyperbolic talk, to be sure. One other statistic is that only 7% of all possible care to prolong, only 7% said that they would want all possible care to prolong life. And we do have some specific barriers here in California, and just in terms of the kind of problems we're talking about, lack of insurance, language barriers, just in terms of determining quality of end-of-life care. But Lisa Krieger, higher education reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, who has certainly established a name for herself in reporting and journalism in the Bay Area for many years now, wrote a personal story about her experience with her father's death. And as I said, I was very touched by the story, and it really got to me, Lisa. I mean, congratulations on, because I know it must have been very difficult to you to write about. But your father comes alive in the story as someone you adored and someone who was a good, hardworking, solid guy, loving father and husband. And the most remarkable thing is that the last 10 days, his hospital bills skyrocketed to $323,000. I mean, that's really something that people have to be aware of, the extraordinary costs.
Exactly. So my dad, who, as you say, I just adored, spiked a fever last July 19th. So I rushed him to the emergency room, because that's what you do when someone you love is sick. And it seemed really simple, and it seemed like I was doing the right thing. This was a man, he was 88. He was pretty frail. He had broken his hip and recently recovered. Pretty depressed since losing my mom, and pretty pronounced dementia. He had real communication problems. But the infection seemed like a really fixable problem. And what I experienced was that when you enter the emergency room, when you enter the hospital, one thing leads to another. There's a whole cascading effect. And within 9 days, yeah, a bill of $323,000. So after I lost him, I started thinking about it. Like, how did this happen? How did saving a life turn into just prolonging death? And it raised the question that just because we can save a life and we have the technologies to save a life, should we? And how do you make those decisions? And my editors at the Mercury News were kind enough to give me a lot of time to go get my dad's medical records, get his bill. I went through my own notes, which I'd kept, and pieced together his story. And what I've discovered is that it's a really universal experience.
I think what you said is the real lesson of this is it's hard to reject world-class medical treatment, but it's easy to get.
Exactly. Exactly.
And by the way, you can read Lisa's story. It's on our website, kqed.org/forum. And as I said, it's really quite a moving story and very personal, but one that I think hits home with and will hit home with a lot of you. The whole talk about just the costs of health care, it always comes down to the fact that it's unsustainable.
It's totally unsustainable. I mean, what we're paying into Medicare and what we're using just don't match up. And aging population, particularly as baby boomers age, we really need to start thinking about how far do we want to go with all this and what makes a good death and how do we create a good death.
Why am I always uncomfortable with that? It always sounds oxymoronic to me.
Michael,
We may not
be afraid of death per se, but we're afraid of pain and we're afraid of suffering. We're afraid of dying alone and we're afraid of being in an anonymous hospital setting. And these are all things we can address. All that being said, my dad thought about that stuff. I mean, that's what made this, you know, there's that phrase, the color of truth is gray. My dad thought about all that stuff. He had a DNR. And when I rushed through the doors of the ER and the doctor said, "You have a DNR," I said, "Yes," because in my mind,
do not resuscitate.
I do not resuscitate. In my mind, what that meant was if he suffered a cardiac arrest, they wouldn't revive him. Pretty clear cut, right? What that doesn't address are all of the other things that kick into motion when you're trying to save a life, which is antibiotics, which is ventilator to help with respiratory support, all the antibiotics, all the immune-boosting drugs, all the blood gases, the testing. I went through and looked at the bill, and, you know, a day in the ICU, the bill was $25,000, which a day, which admittedly is a charge, not the true cost. That's a complicated issue I'm sure our experts can get into here. What would have helped me was a view from 30,000 feet up saying, where are we headed with all this? And what are my spectrum of choices? When you go into the ER, yes, you know, you need to know you have a DNR, but you might also need to know that there are other things available. And my experience was that as we began losing him, it was up to me to raise the topic. What happens if none of this works?
I have an acquaintance who just lost her mother and who said the mother had pneumonia. She came in with a piece of paper, no antibiotics, nothing.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Here's the paper.
Exactly. And that's what you want to be thinking about. Maybe when you first get that diagnosis of dementia or maybe for your 80th birthday, to put that into place. What I found was once the system kicks into gear, because diagnosing is what they do beautifully. Treating is what they do beautifully. They're much less comfortable saying, do you want to stop? And it's very hard. It was very hard for me to say to the doctors, should we stop because he's 88? Should we stop because, you know, he's an old man, he's demented? It didn't feel like an appropriate conversation, but it was a conversation we needed to have. And we did it in a crisis, and I should have done it earlier.
Well, so much of that crisis and that decision falls on the doctors, and Alexander Smith is in here, assistant professor of medicine. I mean, they look to you, many of these patients, as God. Tell us, is our father or mother going to live? Are they going to die? Is it going to die? Is it going to be suffering and so forth? Sometimes questions that you can't answer, and you want to provide hope for people, and sometimes the tea leaves can't actually foresee whether or not someone is going to expire. This is a tremendous burden on physicians, but physicians need to step up to the plate more and talk to their patients, don't they?
I absolutely agree. I think you've hit the nail on the head in that patients want honest information, but they also expect physicians to give them optimistic information. And I think that's where physicians get caught up in giving overly optimistic estimates of what might happen in the future. On the other hand, I also think it's important to acknowledge that there's always uncertainty about these decisions and that there may be a chance that things might turn out differently. And I think that's what, one of the pieces that was so poignant about your story, is that these doctors and you, and I see this happening on a day-to-day basis in the hospital, are caught up in this, well, what if? What if there's a chance that things turn around? Because there is a chance. On the other hand, I think physicians in general don't do as good a job talking about, as you said, the alternatives to intensive life-sustaining treatment and the harms and burdens of such treatment.
And didn't you have a piece in the New England Journal of Medicine which showed that older patients are actually more ready to talk to physicians than maybe those clinicians think they are?
That's absolutely right. And this was based on empirical evidence. So we did a study here in San Francisco where we interviewed 60 older adults who had some form of disability, were living at home, cared for at home in the OnLock program in San Francisco. And we asked them, if your doctor thought that you had about 5 years left to live, would you want them to share that information with you? And we found that a majority did, and for good reasons, to prepare financially, to prepare spiritually, to prepare emotionally. But a minority did not want to have such conversations, also for good reasons. They said, you know, if I have symptoms, just treat them. I don't want to dwell on the fact that I'm dying. There is a reluctance among certain people to engage in these conversations, and we need to be respectful about that as well.
Well, let's talk about that, because I alluded to it earlier. I think, I mean, whenever the subject comes up, we strike head on how verboten talking about death is, mm-hmm. and what a forbidden topic it is in general.
Yeah.
And difficult for many people, just to even, I'm not talking about people who are facing life's end and the shade coming down. I'm talking about, you know, the loved ones.
That's right. I think that fear of death is normal. This is a normal instinct for self-preservation, you know, at some basic psychological level. I also think that in certain groups, there may be more of an effort to struggle to survive. And that's true particularly for minority patients. And I've seen this struggle to survive in the face of history of racism or unequal treatment. On the other hand, I think that so acknowledging that is important. I think we work at cross purposes when we try and frame the conversation around dying, death, end of life care, and that instead, as Lisa suggested later, we need to frame the conversation around promoting informed choices between physicians and patients and family members, providing honest and accurate information about prognosis, understanding that there are burdens, harms, as well as benefits to potential treatments, and working together to make realistic, informed decisions. Now, notice none of that involved death, dying, end-of-life care. We need to reframe the conversation around making informed choices, matching treatment preferences to patients' goals.
And those conversations can follow with the reframing much easier. I mean, that's, I think, implicit in what you're saying. It would be far less difficult for people to talk about if you reframe it. I mean, it almost comes down to a linguistic thing, doesn't it?
It does, but it's also more honest, I think, to the conversation, because I practice clinically palliative medicine at the VA. I'm not an end-of-life doctor. If you, Lisa, had an end-of-life specialist come talk with you at the beginning of this hospitalization, that may have been uncomfortable, and it sort of flew in the face of what the doctors were saying. Well, maybe there's a chance. But I practice palliative medicine, and my focus is on improving the quality of those conversations.
We should mention that there's a new wave of palliative care specialists. In fact, the numbers have increased tremendously, and part of concern over the kind of issue we're talking about is the generational difference between those who are talking to older patients who are younger and older patients. Some, frankly, have said, I guess this is also in your study in the New England Journal of Medicine, that they're more comfortable talking to their contemporaries than they are these young whippersnappers types like yourself.
That is true.
We're also, I think, have to factor into this just the fact that we are a death-denying culture and we're a youth-oriented culture, and that's part of what we face in all this. Charles Garfield is founder of Shanti, clinical professor of psychology. Charlie, we go back a long way to when you were a weightlifter and you were doing imaging and trying to imagine yourself lifting weights that were perhaps beyond what you were capable of doing and sometimes actually doing it. How much of that kind of thinking plays into the end of life?
Well, yeah, you have better memories of all of that than I do, actually. I think that the most important thing that I'm taking out of this very astute conversation is the difference between an appropriate death and an appropriated death. If you take a look at what we mean by an appropriate death, a death in the terms of the person dying, then of course what we need are conversations up front by skilled practitioners who are used to having these conversations, who are not death denying in the traditional sense. An appropriated death is a death stolen from the individual, stolen in the sense that what actually happens is much different than what the person might want to have happen. And that appropriation can occur because of the power of the social system that the drama takes place in. It may take place because of family members who have different feelings than the patient. I think what we're looking at is a kind of sensitivity that we're just starting to develop, where physicians, nurses, others have the training up front to have these conversations and are as comfortable, eventually become as comfortable with these kinds of conversations as they are with conversations about treatment. But we're a ways away from that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do we get closer to that kind of goal?
Well, I think it requires training, and it requires, you know, if all of the curriculum committees of all of the medical schools and nursing schools took these issues as seriously as they take other important issues, then I think that you'd find the training of young docs and young nurses and mental health professionals and others involved in all of these discussions, you'd find those young ones validating and understanding and valuing these issues as much as they value treatment and cure and the other imperatives of healthcare.
There are also really some, and I think you've highlighted this, listening skills that are important, but also being able to broach these topics and frame them in the correct way, as Dr. Smith was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about listening skills, but how much training does the average physician and nurse get in actual listening skills? I mean, I don't mean just a 1 hour lecture or less in something called active listening. I mean really attending fully to the desires and needs and fears and hopes and dreams of the patient. How much training do people actually get in that? Very, very little. And we're a long ways away from a kind of sensitivity that would allow for and validate these issues, the kind that we're having in this discussion, at as high a level of importance as some of the other, as I said, as some of the other imperatives that we hold dear.
Should doctors be more aware of the spiritual side of things? Because I know there are many who say, this is the clergy's job. It's not my job.
Yeah, well, when they say it's the clergy's job, what they really mean, I mean, and this goes back to when I first started doing this work 40 years ago. What they mean when they mention clergy is somebody coming in way at the end, a clinical pastoral counselor, perhaps, who comes in way at the end of the drama.
Charlie, excuse me, hold that thought, because we're coming up on a break here, and I want to give the phone number, and I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. You can do that toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so feel free to join us, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about end-of-life decisions, certainly an important conversation many people avoid, and that's not a judgment. If you need to avoid it, then that's what you feel is important in your life as you come to the end of life, or your loved ones come to the end of life. That's a choice. But a new study by the California Healthcare Foundation shows that a large majority of Californians say they would prefer, for example, a natural death at home. They would prefer to determine their own fate in that sense as they come toward the end of life. and also do it at little expense to their families. But this new survey, which, by the way, you can find on our website, kqed.org, shows that more often than not, they don't get the wish because they haven't done anything. They haven't had the conversation with a physician. They haven't made the documents that are necessary. And we're talking with Kate O'Malley, who is a senior program officer of the California Healthcare Foundation, and Lisa Krieger here with us in studio, higher education reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, who wrote a personal story about her experience as her father died. And you can read that story on our website, again, kqed.org/forum. Alexander Smith with us in studios, assistant professor of medicine in UCSF's Division of Geriatrics, co-founder of GeriPal blog. And Charles Garfield with us by phone is founder of Shanti, clinical professor of psychology at UCSF and a visiting scholar at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. We're going to go to your calls. And by the way, the toll-free number, again, should you care to join this conversation, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post any comments you have or questions on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page. So there are a number of ways to communicate with us, and we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. Before I went to the break, though, we were talking to Dr. Charlie Garfield, and you were talking about really people sort of fobbing this off on the clerical toward the end. But then there are those also, I think, that we need to factor into this who don't necessarily want. I'm thinking of my friend, the late Christopher Hitchens, who didn't want any spiritual guidance. In fact, who said, you know, if I say I believe in God or anything like that, it's the chemo talking. But people need certainly something along the lines of spiritual guidance at the end for the most part, don't they?
Well, I think that many people need the option of having somebody who's skilled in having spiritual conversations, somebody who does it for a living, somebody who's really trained to do it well, rather than having a peripheral person, say a member of the clergy. And I say peripheral not because they should be peripheral, but because they often are in how these dramas unfold. The person who has the greatest training and talent, the kind of person who has the greatest training and talent in these issues would be members of the clergy and, to some extent, mental health professionals also, some mental health professionals as well. But they're often not involved as centrally in all of this, and often the patient never sees them or rarely sees them. So the conversations happen cryptically. These are enormously important conversations that happen in contexts where there's not enough time and not enough training.
Lisa Krieger, you were saying off air, though, that there often has to be, and dementia notwithstanding, a final conversation about saying goodbye.
Absolutely. And that's what palliative care offers you. Two points I want to make about communication with doctors, if I could, really quickly. One was, I think it's really important for doctors to talk to the family about what happens once the patient leaves the hospital. And I've heard from an incredible number of people who have loved ones who are bedridden, they've lost mental function, they'll never be able to walk again. And I think that, you know, the doctors feel often that their job's over once they've treated the patient, when in fact the family inherits this. And the family needs to know that's where we're headed with this. But the second point, which is even more important, and that is, this gets to the issue of palliative care. When you quit treatment, it's not really quitting. It's not that you're doing nothing. You're offering pain support, and you're giving a huge gift to families of time. And what families can say is to this person they're losing, that I love you dearly. I've always loved you. Your memory will continue forever. You've lived a good life. We're so grateful that you are here with us. And often when you're busy fighting, you don't have that chance. And that's what palliative care can offer. And people know that, need to know that it's not quitting. It's actually a gift, and it's an opportunity. What more is there? I mean, we will all die. What do you really want to know? You want to know that you've been loved, and you want to know that people will remember you. And palliative care gives you a chance to express that.
I also want, if I may, to put in a personal note here about hospice care, because it's often so extraordinary at end of life. Just under 42% of all deaths come under hospice care, and the people who do hospice work have always been heroic to me. But I think a lot of people make a mistake, and I'm speaking personally now. I think I made a mistake with one of my parents, thinking hospice care means it's all over. You know, you've just pulled the shade down. And sometimes hospice care really can be palliative care, and it can be maintenance of keeping pain away as much as can be. And I mean, it does mean the end of things usually, but not necessarily as imminent as some people immediately associate it with. Did you want to say something about that,
sure.
Dr. Smith?
I'm happy to talk about that. My training is in palliative medicine. I would say that palliative care is interdisciplinary care. So you're talking about having chaplains involved and having psychologists involved, social workers, you know, attending to all forms of suffering, not just physical suffering, but psychological, spiritual sources of suffering. And it provides care for patients who are diagnosed with serious illness and can be delivered concurrently with intensive life-prolonging care, curative-based care. And it's appropriate for patients anywhere from the time of diagnosis throughout the rest of their lives. It's focused on three main areas: communication about goals and values so that patients match their treatments to their preferences, about excellent symptom management, pain and non-patient pain symptoms, and also setting up the most appropriate services for patients wherever they may be. So when patients are leaving the hospital, making sure that they have the support to live each day as good as it can be at home, and oftentimes that involves referral to hospice programs.
And we're going to go to our callers, and we begin, Matt, with you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to make a comment. I recently got back from Maine last Saturday. I live in San Francisco. And the reason why I had to fly back to Maine on emergency notice was that my mother was taken into the hospital to have emergency surgery. She survived the surgery. She was in intensive care for 3 weeks. She was on a ventilator. She had a feeding tube. And my brothers and I had to make the decision whether or not to keep her on a ventilator or to remove the ventilator. Incredibly hard decision, and we had to really put ourselves in my mother's mindset whether or not she would want to live on a ventilator. We decided to remove the ventilator. She survived, surprisingly survived, because she was very weak going in. She had onset Alzheimer's and was very, very weak, poor diet. But she survived, and a few days later, after finally clearing out the anesthesia, we had to discharge her from the hospital. We put her in long-term care. And I can tell you that she was very unhappy with that. She wouldn't talk to us. She wouldn't look at us. I could just see in her eyes that, you know, she had wished she had died. I feel horrible that we had to make that decision. And I just, you know, listening to this program, it just makes me realize that even though I always say I never want to live on a ventilator, I need to write that down and I need to make it official, or else someone else is going to come to the same situation that I was in recently.
Matt, thank you so much for that story. I mean, it's such a, let's go back to you, Alex Smith, on this, an extraordinary onus. I went through the same thing. I mean, to say, should I take my parent off a ventilator? Mm-hmm. Because in a sense, you're saying, I'm going to give her, I'm going to take away life.
Mm-hmm. These decisions are extraordinarily complex, and even with the best conversations in advance, even with, you know, terrific documentation and advanced directives in pulsed forms, it doesn't take away the complexity of these decisions. I went through a similar thing with my father, who had a brain cancer and wanted to live the remainder of his days in hospice. But before we could enroll him, he fell and hit his head, and he ended up having emergency neurosurgery and dying in the ICU. And we made the decisions to undergo those treatments knowing that his preference had been to die at home, but because there was some chance that he might recover. And, you know, so even with the caller example, he says that he doesn't want to be on a ventilator, but what if he had some potentially reversible condition? And that runs all the way from simple anaphylaxis, so a reaction, allergic reaction to something, where he might be on a ventilator for 2 days and then recover, to having a pneumonia, where maybe he needs to be on a ventilator for a week and then is likely to recover. So can we always say definitively never?
No, we can't. So. I mean, when my mother was on a ventilator, she was in a coma, and there was always a notion that maybe she would come out of the coma, or maybe she was taking things in that we didn't know because we couldn't quantify that. I mean, there's... Yeah, all my bioethicist friends said, take her off the ventilator. But, you know, in a sense, this is the person who gave me life.
Mm-hmm.
Anna, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
I'm a
medical student, and I wanted to comment that we do get training on having these conversations, and I'm very grateful for that. I think it's important to have that be part of the care and to have people have a chance to make those choices while they can still participate in the discussion. And I wanted to ask about policies for making our system support that better since it was taken off the table last year.
Well, let me go back to Kate O'Malley because, again, the senior program officer of the California Healthcare Foundation, and their study actually got us started in looking at this and investigating it and thinking, again, that it was an important topic for us to visit once more. Kate O'Malley, from your study, what did you extrapolate about what might be applied to, for example, teach and train physicians better?
Well, a couple things. One of the questions that was in the study was asking about should physicians be paid to have these conversations? And I think the health policy question that the caller might have been alluding to was in the healthcare reform debates, the issues around taking the possibility of paying physicians for their time. And I think it's certainly fair to pay people to spend their time doing something that requires skill and talent and compassion and needs to be learned and modeled and prepared to do. I think it's appropriate that there should be a reimbursement for that.
And didn't about 80% of those you queried agree with that?
Yes, they did. And when we actually drilled down further to the respondents' political affiliations, we found that across the board that people felt that the time of physicians and healthcare providers to help prepare them to make these good decisions was something that should be compensated. So I think we were happy to see that and saw it as a signal that there may be some policy implication here for adding these types of conversations to certainly the fee-for-service Medicare program and in other ways that physicians are paid and other types of healthcare systems. We do know people are waking up around this issue and are helping their providers spend the time, as we've heard from other panelists, to learn these skills and to have these conversations. And in thinking about it, you know, thinking about who are the heroes in healthcare and who are our models in healthcare, are the people who have these types of skills really the people who are rewarded and who are praised? I mean, I think some of the things that occur to me is that where's the downside for not having the skill to have these conversations, and where's the accountability in the system to make sure that they happen, that people are offered information so they can make the decisions? And those are the kinds of policy issues and questions I think could be pursued.
Again, Kate O'Malley is Senior Program Officer with the California Healthcare Foundation. She's with us from San Diego. And again, you can read the study on our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to another caller. Ramsey, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm an infectious disease physician often involved at end-of-life care in the hospital setting. And the reason I get involved is we have a lot of patients a lot of patients are sort of at the end of their lifespan, but families keep pushing to do more despite a terrible or terminal prognosis. And a lot of times there's been some discussion previously, or a lot of times no discussion about end-of-life planning and end-of-life care. And, having worked on both sides as outpatient doc and inpatient doc, I think that doctors just don't have the time or resources. I applaud all the efforts that everybody is committing, but I also think we need to talk about sort of a task-shifting approach and then to place some of the burden on society at the front end so that society is more aware of these issues in general, not just a doctor-patient issue. And then at the end of life, we all heard about the discussion with death committees, what some people labeled, but there's got to be something for these lot of patients that eat up a lot of our Medicare dollars whose care is futile, but we're forced to care for them. I do this multiple times every day. I care for patients who have a terminal prognosis at the expense of the taxpayer. Thanks.
I thank you for those comments. I appreciate hearing them. Let me go back to Charles Garfield because there may be something attitudinal here that we can address just for the moment from that call. Charlie Garfield, I'd like to hear what you have to say. I remember former governor of Colorado, Richard Lamb, talking about how leaves fall off the tree and people have to realize that those leaves are going to fall and new leaves have to come in their place. It was sort of poetry to talk about something that people often don't address, as we've said repeatedly on this program. How much do you really have to foster a kind of attitude that changes toward just realizing that death is part of life?
I think it's a central issue, Michael. I think we've said so many times, so many of us, that this is a death-denying culture. So if we accept the fact that it is predominantly death-denying, then what does it take to change a cultural mazeway? What does it take to change a cultural norm so that we're willing to approach these issues more consciously? Can we actually say that anyone can truthfully come to terms with death? We're talking about issues that are really very basic to the culture, and they're not gonna change just because somebody has brief training in listening skills and counseling skills. They're gonna have to be. I agree with the caller who said that it's society's issue as well. You know, there are so many other issues that come across the lifespan that we deal with much better than we deal with end-of-life issues. What if we took seriously the end-of-life considerations and took them seriously the way we take seriously any of the other issues along the lifespan? What if, for instance, we took the training necessary to really have these conversations elegantly and well and in advance, and starting at midlife, for instance, not at the end of life, to really weave these issues into what it means to live a life? I think we're talking about much larger issues in the final analysis than anything that happens at the end of life.
And Charles Garfield, again, is founder of Shanti and clinical professor of psychology at UCSF. And Lisa Krieger.
Yeah, excellent point. Thank you, Charlie. When thing I'd like to say, though, is that I think the death-defying culture is fairly new. And until 100 years ago, this was a very agrarian culture. We lived on farms. Animals were born and died all the time. You know, grandpa might die in the living room, and we were all part of that. And you grew up being very familiar with death. And I think what's happened is that as medicine has gotten become so successful and our hopes and expectations for it are so high, and we've really medicalized death. And I think Charlie's point's an excellent one, and that is to get back to these conversations about death being part of life and to have these midlife conversations and to quit being so afraid of it and to quit looking to medicine to fix everything and be the answer.
Let me go to some of our listeners' responses from email and from the website. Laura writes, "My mother was treated at the end of her life by the most extraordinary palliative care doctor, B.J. Miller, UCSF. He transformed the end of my mother's life and our family. While her oncologists were unskilled and unemotional in the matters of palliative care, B.J. was a lifeline to the depth and meaning of the end of life. My hope is that UCSF will be able to put a required palliative rotation into curriculum of clinicians studying medicine." Another listener, David, writes, "Miss Krieger's captured beautifully and sadly the experience of too many families at the end of life of a loved one. This points out a major limitation of primary care physicians not being involved in their patients' hospital care with the widespread adoption of hospitalist programs. At the beginning of her father's ordeal, a physician should have sat down and talked about quality of life issues, including that at best he might get back to his pre-morbid status, which he would not have wanted to be maintained. Just because we have all this medical technology doesn't mean we are obligated to utilize it. But key to the discussion with patients' families is not to make them feel guilty or responsible in some way for their loved one's death, but that letting nature take its course is an appropriate and humane action." Thank you, David. Philip writes, "Thank you for this program. We live in a society where we avoid talking about death. My mother suffered from Alzheimer's disease for 7 years, and as her primary caregiver, I concentrated on keeping her comfortable and with dignified care. We had someone read to her, feed her, provided her with the clothes she always wanted. My goal was to make sure that we had a very detailed living will and DNR, comfortable and relatively free from pain. She gave me life, and I helped her with a good death, one of the most important achievements of my life." On the web, A listener writes, my dad recently passed away after 3 years of decline in his health. About 6 months before his death, his doctor told him that he was not going to get better. His body was just breaking down. He had a wonderful visiting nurse, whom my mother is still close to, and she became his hospice nurse. They were open and honest about what hospice would and would not do. Despite all these medical issues, my 82-year-old mother was able to care for him until he died peacefully in his home with my mother holding his hand. He died with dignity and where he wanted to be. This was because not only was it discussed among our family that he would die at home, but also because of the honest and caring doctors and nurses who treated him with respect. Sheila says, it really depends on the income level of the patients. My grandmother was of sound mind and had a stroke that left her paralyzed on one side. The doctors were ready to sail her down the river. We had to fight for health care on her behalf. We are not poor, but being middle class, they just seemed not to care. Also, it could be a racial issue, too. Not sure what the influencing factor was. Another listener writes, hospitals routinely overcharge by enormous amounts. My mother, who died recently, was charged $350,000 for several days in intensive care before her death. What Medicare ended up paying for those charges was more like $50,000. There was no cost to the family. I don't think it helps for the author to exaggerate the cost problem. Let me just read a few more of these. A lot of people obviously want to share their stories and so forth, but here's someone who asked for some advice. I'm 60 and single, no kids, and my mother has really been on my case to make a will, make death plans, etc. I really should do it, but I keep putting it off. What's the best way to go about this? Do I need a lawyer? and compliments the show. Who wants to jump in here? Kate O'Malley, some advice?
Well, one thing that I would point the writer to is on our website we have a link to a document that was developed by the American Bar Association. It's a simplified advanced healthcare proxy where you can name a decision maker if you cannot make a decision for yourself. And that sounds like a good first step for this individual to think about related to healthcare decisions.
Let me bring in a few more of our emails. A lot of people telling stories, and some of them are horror stories, as you can imagine. Some are really very inspiring and heartwarming stories. Here's a listener, Craig, who says, my 70-year-old mother was recently admitted to the hospital for 3 weeks when a Kaiser urologist in Sacramento prescribed a drug that destroyed her lungs and missed all the symptoms. During her hospital stay, a palliative care specialist visited my mother uninvited. This sent my mother in a tailspin and led her to believe she was dying soon. And my question is, when is it appropriate for the hospital to initiate the discussion without the family's knowledge or consent? Dr. Smith.
We always try to make sure that the patient and the family are on board with the idea of palliative care coming to see them before we go into that room, because our goal is to really develop a strong relationship with the patient and their family. And we want to make sure that we address any misconceptions about what palliative care is up front, okay? Because oftentimes patients and family members do see us as, you know, the quote-unquote death squad, or we're the end-of-life physicians.
You're not the Grim Reaper with your scythe.
That's right. So we do a tremendous amount of education with patients and family members about who we are and what we do, that our focus is really on quality of life, making informed choices, living each day as good as it can be. That is the goal of our of what we do. It is not about reducing costs. It is not about getting people out of the hospital quickly. It's about relief of suffering and promotion of well-being.
Well, here's a listener, Ray, who says, someone who works in the aging field in the community, I find it frustrating that these conversations seem to be limited to hospitals or clinics. I believe we are finding that one place to start these conversations is in the community, such as presentations at senior centers, where many people are open to having these discussions in a less threatening environment. Another point made by a listener named Beth, I teach about cultural diversity and end-of-life care to healthcare professionals, helping them to become aware of their own beliefs and values around end-of-life, and then discover where they have common ground with their patients and families, where to begin the conversation with respect to cultural beliefs and values. Some cultural groups believe that talking about death makes it happen. Native Americans, for example, she says, and that negative words and thoughts may be self-fulfilling. Here the practitioner could use the third person. For example, some people have these troubles. Or with an elderly Chinese American, talking about death with her or him may bring anxiety and depression. The individual may request that all information and decisions are made by the eldest male. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Millbrae. Marla, join us. Welcome.
Hi. This is such a wonderful program. I am 52, and I was diagnosed 3 years ago. I have fourth-stage brain melanoma, and I've actually been very lucky that I've had some test drugs and things be able to, medications that are not FDA approved to help me, but I'm coming to the end of being helped. It's and not curable. It's just a matter of when, you know, my last days are. It's not a matter of if. So it's really interesting because I feel like I can make so many comments about everything as far as health care because I am on Medicare and Medi-Cal, and I could make so many comments on different doctors and diagnoses and so many different things because over the last 3 years I've been my own advocate. I have a really close family of 6 siblings and a mother that is completely supportive. The one thing that I really sort of want to make a point about that, you know, I'm not religious, but I have been my own advocate for the last 3 years so strongly, fighting for every single thing that I've been able to, you know, help in my care, fighting for the best care. I go to UC San Francisco and I have been so lucky with the best oncologist and the best care and so many other things as far as I would never have been able to afford the care, but by fighting for my rights for Social Security, fighting for Medi-Cal, fighting for all these things.
Marla, I'm sorry. Just keep fighting and hang in there. I'm sorry for what you're going through and for the prognosis that you have, but I appreciate very much your calling in, and thank you for that. We've come to the end of this program, and what a program it's been. I want to thank all who participated, Kate O'Malley from the California Healthcare Foundation, Lisa Krieger from the San Jose Mercury News, Dr. Alex Smith from UCSF's Division of Geriatrics, and Charles Garfield from the also from UCSF and also visiting scholar at the GTU. You can continue this on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page and continue your columns. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti-Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.